The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Michelle Sheffer. I'm the writer and editor here, and I'm so honored to introduce tonight three wonderfully gifted writers, true masters of language and of the craft of storytelling. They're the kind of writers who make me want to be a better reader. I do a little happy dance on my doorstep, and I'm not even really that embarrassed by it, every time I get a new issue of The New Yorker, and it contains a story by Tessa Hadley. Her new novel, Clever Girl, is a story that doesn't overreach, about a character who feels real, told in prose that isn't ornate, yet is startlingly exact. The effect is a fine and well-chosen pileup of experiences that gather meaning and power, according to a review in the New York Times. Colm Toybean's characters and their stories, rendered in similarly fine and careful prose, live with you long after you finish reading. His new novel, Nora Webster, is a rare and tremendous achievement, according to none other than Tessa Hadley, in a review from The Guardian. The novel does everything we ought to ask of a great novel, that it responds to the fullness of our lives, be as large as life itself. And the prolific Jane Smiley's intelligent and engaging writing captivates you at the same time it challenges you. Her new novel, Some Luck, is the first in a trilogy, which is very exciting. USA Today calls it a masterpiece in the making, intimate, miraculous, the auspicious beginning of an American saga. Tessa will read first tonight, followed by Colm, and then Jane. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Tessa Hadley, Colm Toybean, and Jane Smiley to the library.
Hello, everybody. Wonderful to be able to gather that many people together for a reading in a library. How marvellous. I have to say, I don't think that would happen in England. So, I'm truly impressed. Okay, I'm going to read a little bit from very near the beginning of my novel, Clever Girl, my last novel. This girl, it's all told, it's the first time I've done this in a novel, it's all told in the first person. And so I have to be very close to where she is. And this girl is born in the same city as me, Bristol, England, in the same year as me, which perhaps I won't name. But she really isn't me, actually. She lives a parallel, different life. It's an alternative life, anyway. All you need to know about her, I think, is that she's grown up with her mum. Her mum's a single parent, bit iffy as to quite what's happened to the dad. Is he dead or just absent? In a couple of rooms in a tall, old, ramshackle Georgian house in Bristol at a time when Georgian houses were not glamorous. They were really seedy. They just have two rooms. It's multi-occupancy. Only thing you need to know is that down in their basement there lives Mrs. Walsh and her grown-up but odd son, Clive. Just before the beginning of what I'm going to read, Stella, that's the name of my girl, who is about 9 or 10 years old, has stayed the night with her grandmother round the corner. And she wakes up very early, and her grandmother doesn't seem to be awake. She's alone in her grandmother's house. And for the first time ever, she thinks, I could just get up and go out and walk round the corner to home and surprise Mum. She's never done this before, and it feels like a step into independence. It feels momentous, and actually it does turn out to be momentous because on her way home and then at home, she finds things out. Just a little earlier from where I'm going to start reading, there's this sentence. I had worried sometimes about making the transition into being grown up. How did you know when to begin? Now I understood that you stepped out into it as simply as into a day. Anyway, she starts walking home. And just, yeah, you need to know this because you might not know it. In the 1960s, oh, I've given it away now, which is when she's 10 years old, England was still littered with bomb sites. Where I grew up, in Bristol, where it had been quite heavily bombed because of the docks, there were bomb sites everywhere, the most left over from the Second World War, of course. The most marvellous places to play in, and a lot of my childhood was in those. I pulled Nana's front door shut behind me. From somewhere far off came the ruminative stop-start of the milkman's electric float, but still I had the morning more or less to myself. I could hear the crepe-soled creak of my sandals on the pavement and the jangled clang of the gate as it closed with finality after me, as if these sounds bounced off the silent houses opposite. I could almost see my surprising self setting out about my own business in the streets, my wind cheater zipped up and my hands in its pockets. I fancied I walked with a masculine, casual bravado, brown hair chopped off in a clean line at shoulder length. I wasn't interested at that point in my life in being girlish. What I admired were horses and the boyish girls who hung around horses. Turning the corner at the end of Nana's street, I started along the path across the bomb site. When I saw a man sitting facing away from me on one of the broken low walls, it was too late to go back, but my heart beat with shy anxiety. I hated the idea of any strange adult speaking to me, perhaps telling me off. Wearing a dark overcoat, the man was bent over with his head in his hands. The path ran close behind where he sat, and hurrying past, I could make out the black cloth of his coat worn to gingery brown across the shoulders, freckled with scurf from his greasy hair. I thought it was strange that an adult man came out to sit alone on a pile of stones. I couldn't imagine either of my uncles doing it. I didn't know much about men, but in my experience, they were always purposefully on their way somewhere. Then I realised that the man was Mrs. Walsh's son, Clive. I hadn't recognised him because it was the first time I'd ever seen him beyond the end of our street. He lifted his head and peered over his shoulder at me, doleful long face, unshaven cheeks and chin, the beard growth speckled with silver. The inner rim of his lower eyelids was lined in sore, wet red. "Come and look at this," he said. Clive was strange. One of his boots was made up with a special thick sole because of his sloping, dragging walk. He had had meningitis when he was 3 and his twin sister had died of it. We had lived in the same house since I could remember, but he and I had an unspoken agreement not to acknowledge each other except when our connection was mediated by our mothers. "Can you believe he had yellow curls once?" Mrs. Walsh would sigh. "Say hello to Stella, Clive. Say hello to Clive," my mother would order, shoving me sharply in the small of the back. She was full of ostentatious pity for the poor thing, but she also thought it might be better for everyone if he was put away, whatever that meant. "It's not much of a life," she said. I'm not sure whether Clive really recognised me that morning. We never spoke about it afterwards. I might have just been any passing little girl. "Look what I found," he said. Warily, I stepped over the wall into the interior of the vanished house. Swallows were flitting and shrieking inside the space they nested there. Against the wall where Clive was sitting, fallen into the cracks in the stones and rolled into the grass, was an improbable slew of buttons of all sorts. Thousands of buttons, much more than a handful or even a tinful. I crouched down to them, wondering, not touching yet. Who do they belong to? How did they get here? Clive said he had known the woman who once lived here and they must be hers. I played here often. I'd never seen the buttons before, but I began to believe him because he was so certain. Did he mean a woman who'd lived in this house before it was bombed? Some of these buttons were old, carved jet ones, brass ones with military insignia, cream cloth-covered ones for shirts. Others looked modern, coloured plastic ones like the ones my Nana put on my cardigans. They were jumbled chaotically together, ordinary black and brown and white ones, a coral rose, wooden toggles, a diamante buckle, big yellow bone squares, toggles made of bamboo. Something about the sheer multiplicity of the buttons, the fact you couldn't get to the bottom of them, started an ache of desire in my chest. I thought that Clive was feeling the same thing. He breathed through his mouth noisily. His cheeks under their strong beard growth were dramatic, hollow as if they'd been carved out with something clumsy like an axe. The raw mask of a man's face was overlaid on his life, which was more like the life of a child. Every afternoon, Clive was allowed to wander out along our road. He always stopped at one particular lamppost, as if it were a limit his mother had set him. He would be standing there when the children came home from school, hunched over, smoking and watching us, wearing his overcoat in winter, a short grey mac in summer. We screamed and ran past him. Even I did, pretending I didn't know him. Every tea time, Mrs. Walsh came out to bring him back, pulling him coaxingly by the hand, a small, bent, fat old woman tugging at a tall, scowling, resisting man, showing her patient smile around to anyone who might see them. "We could take some home for your mother," I suggested. But I wanted the coral rose for myself, or the buckle. I put my hand out to pick them up. Angrily, Clive pushed it away, scuffing some of the buttons into the dirt with his normal boot. "Don't touch them, leave them," he scolded. Close up, I could smell his familiar smell, the same as in their flat, stale like damp feather cushions or mouldy bread, mixed up with something perfumed he put on his hair, or his mother did. Reasonably, I pointed out that if anyone wanted them, they shouldn't have thrown them away, but he didn't listen. He was preoccupied, sorting through the buttons with clumsy, yellow-stained fingers as if he was searching for one in particular. Clear snot glistened on the curves of his upper lip. I watched jealously, crouched on my haunches, balancing on the balls of my feet with my hands on my knees. Really, where could so many buttons have come from? Someone might have had a button shop and given it up, but then why pour it out here? I was frustrated that Clive was not a real adult who could offer answers, though often they only dismissed my questions. "Oh, Stella, don't be silly. Whatever for?" Clive held the big button up to the light. It was pearly white, so translucent it was almost green, carved with a leggy bird with a long beak, perhaps a heron. I had never thought with any interest about clothes before, but I had a heady vision in that instant of a black velvet cape, full length, dragging behind me along the smooth floor of a place I'd never been. I couldn't help reaching out to take the bird button. Clive smacked at my hand. "They're not yours," I said indignantly. "They're anybody's." Then he pushed me hard on the knee so that I overbalanced and fell backwards. Standing up, he towered over me. It was a surprise to be reminded of how wholly he filled out his big man's body. Because of the child's life he led, traipsing everywhere after his mother, it was easy to discount his grown-up shape, as if he'd only borrowed it, the way girls dressed up in their mother's shoes and lipstick. Now I saw that Clive's size fitted around him inevitably as mine did around me, and that he was at home in it. In fact, because he walked sloppily and mumbled to himself, he was more deeply burrowed away inside his body than other grown-ups were. Other grown-ups, especially women, had learned somehow to live on the surfaces of their bodies, controlling them and presenting a prepared version of them to the world. Sometimes when Clive stood under the lamppost and watched the children coming home from school, you could see he was rubbing himself with his hand down in his trousers, not in any kind of sinful frenzy, more as if he was only half aware of doing it, comforting and reassuring himself. There was an old man who did something like this at the swimming baths too, sitting on the edge of the pool, staring at the girls squealing and splashing, rocking himself backwards and forwards against the pool's rim. If you caught the pool man's eye, he was jeering and slippery, whereas if Clive ever looked at you, he was contemptuous, as if you had nothing for him. "Don't look," my mother snapped, if she saw Clive busy in his trousers. She would close her expression tight as if it was my fault for shaming her. "Cross the road, Stella." I ought to have been afraid of him that morning, but I wasn't. I'd been relieved all along that it was Clive I met on the bomb site and not a stranger. In relation to Clive, I was still powerful and not obliterated. When he stood looming over me, I felt more outrage than fear and rolled over, scrambling to my feet, dusting off my knees, which were not grazed but lightly stuck with bits of gravel and grass. I wasn't hurt in the least, only surprised and humiliated. "You are not supposed to push me." He took a step towards me, making a threatening gesture with his hand in the air like the one my mother made to me sometimes. I stepped backwards, deliberately insouciant. Then I turned and skipped away. How I used to love that skipping. 2 bounces on the one foot, then 2 on the other, which carried you as fast as 7-league boots, buoyant and flinging forwards, rebounding off the ground each time with double strength. Clive came lumbering after me, but I knew he couldn't catch me. The smack of his heavy boots when he reached the pavement was loud as gunshots in the empty street. I stopped and waited for him by the grocer's shop, where the beige sun blinds, cracked and torn, were still drawn down inside the windows. Between the glass and the blinds was stacked a pyramid of tins of peas, their labels faded almost to illegibility. I'd looked at those peas 1,000 times. "Here," grunted Clive when he caught up with me, stopping at a respectful distance, holding out his big, greeny-white fist. I held out my open hand to him. He gave me the coral rose and the diamante buckle. I still have them.
Thank you very much for coming. It's an honour to read with Tessa Hadley and Jane Smalley. I'm delighted to be here. The Irish painter Tony O'Malley went into exile and lived for many years in St. Ives in Cornwall and painted there. In the mid-1980s, he came back to Ireland because a retrospective of his work was organised and toured various small places in Ireland. And he came back to the town of Enniscorthy, the town where I'm from, and where much of this novel is set. And he had lived in the town, I think, I would estimate about 38 years earlier, where he worked in the bank. And he walked through the town for the first time in all those years, and he met people. And, of course, 38 years isn't very long, and they all knew him. And one woman came up and said, you know, her mother had run the boarding house where Tony O'Malley had stayed all those years before. And she just said to him casually as she was walking away, "By the way, that suitcase you left, it's still there if you ever want it. I mean, you know, do come round." So he called round and he thought he had lost all those drawings and gouaches and watercolours. He just thought they were somewhere in the years. They had just disappeared. And his wife had said to him, you know, you're missing those drawings from those years. And he said, no idea where they are. They were in the suitcase to the brim. And the problem was that, some of them were from the town and, they were absolutely exact. And he had gone for walks outside the town, absolutely exact the way he had worked on things. But there were some of them that somebody could have thought, this is a landscape you've invented, because in those almost 40 years, the landscape had changed, because he had painted the eroding coast of County Wexford, and done watercolors of a hill, especially the hill behind Keating's house in Ballyconiger Lower, which doesn't exist anymore, which only some people remember. I remember it. But there'll come a time when no one will remember it. It will be as though it was never there, except in some of the drawings and gouaches and watercolours that Tony O'Malley made. At the beginning of this novel, Nora Webster, who's been going to this landscape, it's 10 or 12 miles from the town of Enniscorthy, so they could go on bicycles when they were young. And then when she got married, much to her absolute delight, they could go and spend part of the summer in a small house they could rent. And that then they bought a little house, and that was the happiest time. The children grew up there in the summers, and then it's all gone because her husband has died and she can't afford to keep the house. But she almost doesn't want to keep it. So she lets it go, she sells it. And she determines that she'll never go back there again. No matter what happens, that is a place she will never return to. So what happens in this chapter I'm going to read is that she ends up back there. Ballyconiger Upper is where the cliffs are, and the cliffs are still eroding. There was a house that, I mean, I went to see the people just coming up to Christmas, and they said, well, this will be our last Christmas here. And sure enough, they've gone into the village, and the roof of the house is all, I mean, you know, it's almost gone. It will be over the cliff really by the end of this year. And my father's first cousin's house, you can see where the rooms were, but that's gone. Anyway, if you go further south, the landscape softens even more. And there's a stretch between Ballyconiger Upper and then Ballyconiger Lower, and then a place called Ballyvaloo. Ballyvaloo then and now had a convent of St. John of God. And when you were kids, it was very exciting because the nuns were still wearing their full habits. And being nursing nuns, they could be in black or white. And when you were a kid, you would shout on the strand, "Mammy, mammy, mammy, look, nuns, two nuns!" Because you two nuns all in black, you could see them coming towards you almost like, you know, they would come out of the sea or something, but they hadn't. They had come out of the retreat house and they still have the retreat house at Ballyvaloo. And then if you go further south again, it's the beginning of the strand gets much longer, and the sand dunes are there, and it's like something in Normandy. It's so much indeed like a place in Normandy that they shot those scenes in Saving Private Ryan there. When they wanted Normandy, they shot them in Curraghclough, just where I am. But this stretch here that I'm talking about is, people don't go there much. And Nora has really had a dreadful time at work. And she's found herself walking out of her job, because she had to go back to work to get some money after her husband died, with a pair of scissors in her hand, which she almost was going to attack somebody at work, which is really unlike her. Or somewhat unlike her. And she has also that day, because she couldn't sleep, she just hasn't been able to sleep. And found herself then, like anyone with insomnia, she went to sleep at the very wrong moment, you know, just before work, and she woke late. So she had to drive the old car over to work and park it badly. And then, so she's walked out of work, and she finds herself with nothing to do for the rest of the day. I mean, she can't think where to go or what to do. The place she's working in is called Gibney's. And her husband, who has died, is called Morris. And it was Morris, in a way, who came to this place first before she ever did. As she turned the car, she decided that she would go to Ballyconiger now. The day was fine and the strand at Keating's would be empty. She would walk, and maybe the walking would give her an idea what she might do. No matter what happened, she would not go back to Gibney's again. She wondered if she could sell the house in Enniscorthy, which is the family house, and rent a smaller house or move to Dublin. It might be easier to find a proper job in Dublin. As she thought about this, she was reminded about what had happened at work, and the fact that they knew so much about her. And so she remembers all the business of going all the years when they used to go there on bicycles. They, herself and her friend, had used all their energy on the bicycles, and they had married these men, and then she stops, and she's just remembering all of this business of going there first, and then meeting her husband, and then she stopped in Blackwater and bought a packet of 10 Carol cigarettes and a box of matches. She had not smoked for years and promised herself that she would not smoke all of these cigarettes either, just two or three before throwing the packet away. When she inhaled, she felt dizzy, and that made her remember how tired she was. She threw the cigarette out of the window and then put her head back and fell asleep. When she woke, she spotted a woman standing on the bridge looking over at her car. As the woman approached, she started the engine. She was tempted to drive to Cush and see the old house, the one she sold, and see if Jack Lacey had done any work on it, but she was sure that her car would be noticed. She toyed for a moment with the idea of driving home and writing to work a sharp letter of resignation. She began to compose it in her mind. But then the energy to do that left her, and she decided to drive towards the sea at Keating's. She had not expected to find a haze over the water. She sat in the car in front of the Keating's house and looked down in the direction of Ross Lair, taking in the heavy, milky light that lay over the strand going towards Carrickloe and Raven Point. When she got out of the car, she felt how unusually close and humid it was, as if there was thunder coming. She put on a pair of flat shoes that she kept in the car. There were no other cars in the car park. She walked carefully on the stony stretch between the grass and the river and crossed the small wooden bridge and made her way south. In all the years, she thought, she'd never come here even as late in the season as October. She imagined now how strange it would be in December and January, how storm-swept and wintry and how biting the cold. There was hardly any colour. The world in front of her had been washed down. If she moved nearer to the shore, she could look at the small stones that made a rattling sound when the waves broke over them. She saw how exact the colour of each stone was, and it allowed her to forget what happened at work and stop worrying about what she should do. She could barely see ahead of her as she walked. It might have been easy to imagine that this was a place that belonged more to Morris than to her. It was the world filled with absences. There was merely the hushed sound of the water and stray cries of seabirds flying close to the surface of the calm sea. She could make out the sun as it glowed through the curtain of haze. It was unlikely that Morris was anywhere except buried in the graveyard where she had left him. But nonetheless, the idea lingered that if he or his spirit was anywhere in the world, then it would be here. She thought it almost natural that if his spirit were on this stretch of strand, he would have his own concerns. The details of her life, her job, or what might happen in the future with the children. These would be matters that would seem as vague to him as the far distance did to her now. Things that would pass as his life had passed. What had happened in the days before his death, the blockage in his system that caused him to cry out so his voice could be heard through the hospital, that would be with him now. More than anything else. He came to her again, his death. She pictured those who were there, Jim and Margaret, his brother and sister. Sister Thomas, the nun from the St. John of God convent, who had said special prayers, and old Father Quaid. For the last 2 days, Nora herself had stayed by his bedside, but he was already far away from them, so far that they might have been like shadows, people already lost to him. Maybe he could only imagine them all as vague presences, the ones he had loved. But love hardly mattered then, just as the haze here now meant that the line between things hardly mattered. As she reached Ballyvaloo, and the luminous grey whiteness was moved down the strand by the mild wind towards Carrickclough, she saw that there was a single nun walking back towards the lane that led to the retreat house of the Sisters of St. John of God. Wearing a full black habit, the nun walked slowly and with difficulty. Nora thought she must be one of the retired nuns who often came here on holiday or on retreat. When she was closer, she saw that the nun was Sister Thomas. Nora was surprised she was in Ballyvaloo. She had not known that she ever spent time away from her own convent and the town. She moved towards her, and when she reached her, Sister Thomas greeted her and put out her hands and took both of Nora's hands and held them. Suddenly, Nora felt cold and began to shiver. She could hear a wind blowing, almost whistling in the distance. But when she looked out at the sea and down the strand, it all seemed calm. There was no sign of the haze lifting. You shouldn't be here on your own, Sister Thomas said. I was in Blackwater this morning to see a friend, and just a while ago she saw you fast asleep in your car and then driving towards the strand, and she phoned me in the convent because she was worried and wanted to know what she should do. So I walked down here in case I would find you. Who saw me? I thought I would come down to the shoreline to see if you were here, Sister Thomas said quietly. I don't often leave the retreat house. Today it's more like heaven than earth down here. I saw her all right, Nora said, someone who can't mind her own business. That is one way of putting it, Sister Thomas said, someone who is looking out for you. Sister Thomas released Nora's hands. I was not surprised to see you down here, Sister Thomas said. It was meant to happen. Us meeting like this. This is how the Lord works. Don't tell me how the Lord works, Nora said. Don't tell me that again. When Morris was dying, Sister Thomas said, I asked the Lord to make it easy for him and for you. I have no needs of my own. And I'd not asked him for anything in a long time, but I asked him for that, and he denied me what I asked. There must have been a reason for saying no, and the reason is hidden from us. But I know that he is watching over you, and maybe that is why we met, so I could tell you that. He has not been watching over me, Nora said. No one has been watching over me. I knew when I woke today and said my prayers this morning that I was to see you. Nora was silent. So turn back now, before the fog comes down so hard that you won't be able to drive home, Sister Thomas said. Go home, and the boys will be home soon. The boys will be home from school waiting for you. I can't work in that job anymore. They shout at me. They said things today that made it impossible for me to stay. It will be all right, Sister Thomas said. It is a small town and it will guard you. Go back to it now and stop grieving, Nora. The time for that is over. Do you hear me? I felt as I walked along here, Nora began. Yes, we all feel that on days like this, Sister Thomas interrupted, and even on other days. It is why we come here. Those who have passed on have it for shelter on their way elsewhere. It is nice to be among them on a day like this. Among them? Nora asked. What do you mean? We walk among them sometimes, the ones who have left us. They're filled with something that none of us knows yet. It is a mystery. She held Nora's two hands again and then turned and walked slowly as though in pain back towards the dunes and the lane leading to the retreat house. Nora waited to see if she would look back, but she did not. So Nora stood for a while without moving, looking out at the sea still covered in haze. And then she began to make her way along the strand towards where she had left the car. The large scissors were still on the front passenger seat beside the packet of cigarettes. She put the cigarettes in the glove compartment, but took the scissors out of the car and left them down on the gravel for someone else to find. Thank you.
Hello. So nice to see you all. And I asked if maybe Charles Dickens' Raven could be brought out, but I was told no. Some Luck is the first volume of a trilogy. The entire trilogy is called The Last 100 Years. Some Luck takes place between 1920 and 1953. The next volume, which is called Early Warning, takes place between 1953 and 1987. And the third volume, which I would like to call A Bad End, but the publisher doesn't like that. That takes place between 1987 and 2019. The initial characters are Walter, who was born in 1895, and Rosanna, who's born in 1900. They have a small farm deeply indebted in Iowa. And I'm going to read a little section. You'll think that maybe we decided to do this thematically, but it's all, you know, just intended to be. So this section takes place in the summer of 1930, when Lillian is almost 4. The moment when Rosanna knew she'd been living in a fool's paradise was the moment she pumped the second basin of water. She'd already undressed Lillian and set her into the first tub of water to cool off. It would certainly be 100 out there at least, and Lillian was paddling mildly and dipping a couple of spoons in and out of her bath. She was half talking to Rosanna. As she said, "Lolly and Lizzie need a nap," and Rosanna answered automatically, "I'm sure they do. They were up late last night." The water that spurted out of the tap over the sink fell brown and thick into the pail, then stopped. Rosanna had never seen a well go dry before. She set the pail down into the sink and put her hands on her hips. Her hands were trembling. The farm had 3 wells, one beside the barn, this one by the house, and an old one that had been capped some years ago not far from the chicken house. Rosanna had no idea how deep this well was or how it compared with the others. Sometimes that didn't matter. Water could be deep or shallow. She glanced over at Lillian. The tub the girl was sitting in was not at all large. It had a flat bottom and flared sides about 12 inches high, and Lillian was sitting with her legs crossed. The water, which was clear, came up about 6 inches. In the hot weather, Rosanna had been letting her sit in the water every afternoon just to stave off any fevers or heat strokes that might be going around. Walter and the boys had a pail outside, too, in the shade that they dipped their bandanas in before wrapping them around their heads under their hats or wrapping them around their mouths and noses to keep out the dust. The other thing Rosanna had taught the boys to do was to dip their wrists in the water and hold them in there long enough for the blood to cool. Well, obviously, the first thing was to pray. So Rosanna set down the pail and went over to Lillian and knelt beside her. She said, "Dear Lord." And Lillian said in a sing-song voice, "Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray." Rosanna couldn't help smiling. She waited for Lillian to finish and went on. "We see that you are preparing a trial for us. The signs and the symbols are all around us. You give us no rain, and now you have dried up our well. Our crops are thirsty, Lord. We dole out little drops of moisture to them every evening, and they drink them up, but still they look yellow and dry." She was thinking of the beans. "We thank you for your past generosity, and we apologize if we have seemed ungrateful, if we have sat down to your bounty without lifting our voices in your praise. We understand that we became proud and flaunted our pride and were punished. Now she was thinking about how Bruno Kraus had come and gone. No customers could afford to pay for such luxuries. She had had to slaughter half of her chickens and given them away, and though at first the experience was a bitter one, it showed her that there were people, and not just bums and vagrants, but people in Denby and Usherton who hadn't the wherewithal to buy a chicken. There were people who were starving in the midst of plenty, as it said in the Bible somewhere. We know that the trials you send us are proper tests of our faith, and we hope to pass these tests, dear Lord. Now she was thinking that Dan Crest was giving her almost nothing for her butter, good as it was. But he said that people didn't care about quality when they could hardly afford to eat. He himself almost went out of business, and it could still happen if the drought, yes, he used the dreaded word, didn't end soon. He had no idea what was next, and neither did Hoover or anybody else. The oat and barley fields were brown, and there weren't many farmers like Walter and his father who had some from the year before. The corn looked like green sticks thrusting out of rock. It was that dry. She gripped Lillian's hand a little too tightly, and Lillian pulled away. She opened her eyes. Lillian said, "Mama, I'm scared. You scared me." And Rosanna coughed and said, "You pray, Lillian. The Lord will listen to you, I'm sure." "Pray what?" Lillian thought for a second, then said, "Darling, just close your eyes and say, 'Dear Father, please have mercy upon your children and keep us and protect us. If there is anything we have done to offend you, we give you our apologies.' Say that." What are apologies? Saying you're sorry, you know, like when you make a mess and Mama has to clean it up. Did I make a mess? No, honey, no, you didn't. I don't know who did, but sometimes you have to say you're sorry and you don't know why. Do you understand? Lillian shook her head. Someday you will. We don't know all the things the Lord sees. Sometimes he sees things that we don't, and they make him sad and angry, and so we have to say we're sorry anyway. Okay, but she still seemed doubtful. Rosanna began again. Dear Father, please take mercy upon us, your children, and help us. Please help us. Rosanna didn't correct her. If we have offended you by doing something, we are sorry. We are sorry if we did a bad thing that we didn't know. Darling, said Rosanna, it might be that someone else did a bad thing, but it's good if we apologize for it, like Jesus. Like Jesus? Well, Jesus never did a single bad thing, but when he was crucified, he made up for all the bad things that other people had done. That's why he was crucified. Lillian looked at her for a moment, then went back to moving her fingers in the water, and Rosanna wondered if she had gone too far. It was always a shock for a child to find out, to truly understand what had happened to Jesus. Rosanna remembered clearly her own reaction of brooding over it for some weeks around Easter and asking the question, "Nails in his palms? Nails? He fell down 3 times and nobody at all helped him? Where was the Good Samaritan?" In fact, it was better to have a rather thoughtless child like Frankie, who listened then forgot about it, who at 10 still sang "Round John Virgin" without recognizing that those words made no sense. Finally, Lillian said without looking at her, Did you do a bad thing, Mama? Not that I know of. Did Papa? Not that I know of. Frankie? She hesitated, but certainly this was true. Not that I know of, then, at this point. Joey? I can't imagine Joey or you, Lillian, doing a bad thing or thinking a bad thought. What is a bad thought? Rosanna regretted even beginning this. She said, hating someone. Do you hate anyone? No, and neither does Papa or Frankie or Joey or you, Lillian. I don't know why there isn't any water, but the Lord will provide if we pray to him. Isn't there any water? Well, said Rosanna, let's see. She stood up and lifted Lillian out of the tub, careful to retain as much of that water as she could for plants and maybe even animals. She dried Lillian with a towel and walked her over to the pump. Rosanna picked Lillian up and set her beside the sink, then picked up not the pail with the muck in it, but a pot that she used for boiling egg noodles. She set it under the spout of the pump, lifted the handle, and pushed it downward. Then it did it again. Water, clear water, and cool, spurted into the pan, and she pumped again. Soon she had about 3 quarts. The pot held 4 quarts. She realized that she had panicked. Dimly, in fact, she knew how a well worked. A well was a deep hole into an aquifer. Water seeping through surrounding rock and earth filled the hole, and every well had a capacity, a gallon a minute or 2 or 10 or whatever. But Rosanna had never in her 30 years seen anything come out of a spigot other than water, and so she had looked at the muck and panicked. Lillian was staring at the water, and Rosanna gave in to temptation and said, "Well, darling, it's a miracle." We prayed for the water, and the water came. Rosanna knew that Walter would disapprove of misrepresenting things in this way, but the words just came out of her mouth. Lillian stared at the water and said, "A miracle." Rosanna took her down from the sink and said, "Let's go find Dula and Lizzie. I think they've been getting up to mischief." As they left the kitchen hand in hand, Rosanna saw Lillian turn her head to look at the pump. She did feel guilty a bit. But then what was wrong in believing with miracles? Miracles abounded. There were plenty that you could see and plenty that you couldn't. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those readings. Everyone, I think you know how this works. If you have a question, raise your hand. We will call on you and we'll get you the mic. Nancy, about halfway back.
I'm just so anxious to read all of your books. I have, Jane, I have yours, and Colm, I have yours. When you started to read tonight, I almost fell out of my chair. My Auntie Bridget, who was also known as Sister Baptista John Donnelly, was a sister of St. John of God. She went to the St. John of God convent as a young girl, as to convent school. When she was 18, she professed her vows, and she was a nurse at the county hospital in Wexford. I said, nobody talks about that place. You know, it's just, it was astounding to me. So I have your book, but I just, as I said, I haven't started to read it yet, so I was quite flabbergasted, but I'm anxious to start.
Does anyone else have a Wexford question or story? Maybe I can ask all three of you a question about time in your books, because I know that, Jane, yours stretches out for a century. Colm, I'm not sure what the full frame of yours is, and Tessa, yours goes for about 40, 50 years, right?
Yes, it starts when she's a little girl and ends when
she's 50. So can you talk about how time, and pick how you want to use it, sort of impinges on your narrative when you're creating it, or affects the ultimate structure?
Well, the first thing I came up with this for this trilogy was the title, The Last 100 Years. So I knew that it was going to pass by year by year, and that the years were going to pass by fairly evenly. But I hadn't done that before. So as a result of that decision, I had to read a lot of history and sort of fit my characters into passing events. And I quite enjoyed it, actually. And I found on my rereadings that it does have an energy, you know, that comes from the passage of time and the maturation and then the, I'm sorry to say, decline of some of my characters.
I love the thought of the bad end.
I keep saying to them, this is a good title.
It is a good title.
My novel is emphatically set in 1968, 69, and then goes on to about 72. And so about three things are happening in the background, but they really are in the background. I mean, one of them is the beginning of the troubles in Northern Ireland, so that, you know, the kids are watching television and shouting upstairs, come down, there's something on the television. And of course it was Derry or it was Belfast. It was both distant and close. And it begins to impinge, but not much on the novel. It's just there in the background. Second thing is the improving of the Irish economy, where suddenly pensions are getting better or systems of welfare are getting better, and that makes a big difference in the novel. And so those budgets described, the 68 and 69, where widows' pensions were increased by a lot of money, I remember this vividly because I was a widow's son and we watched the television, and when the minister said that he was going to increase the widow's pension, we, hold on a minute, shh! What did he say? What did he say again? And that he back, you know. And the third thing was the moon landing, which, you know, I remember. So that those things are, and it ends with Bloody Sunday, which was the, which, you know, the sort of shooting of the unarmed civilians in Derry. And so the novel is very much in those years, but I had to be very careful to let those years just be in the background, almost in a painting, as though you were to have some buildings or some shapes in the background, but in the foreground is the character, is the main character.
In mine, I've read both the other books, both wonderful books, and both of you sort of inhabit the moment, very much not knowing what's going to happen next, don't you? It's one of the things a writer decides, and you can do it either way. And in mine, the whole of the book is implicitly written from after the end of the book. It's implicitly written by a woman in her 50s. Not she doesn't say so, but you can hear her voice commenting. So that's one of the interesting things that you have to choose about time, is whether you're embedded in the moment and you don't know, whether the narrative doesn't know what's going to happen next, or whether you comment on it with a kind of knowingness. But of course, you don't want to give too much away. You don't want to lose the tension of the created moment. So it's a really interesting... Their time in a novel is one of the first things you have to make up your mind about, isn't it?
Can you share with us who you enjoy reading?
Shall I start on it this time? That was very genuine. I love both of these books. I read lots of old books. I'm actually always really slow on contemporary books. I wait, usually, not always, not in this case, but usually I wait and see how kind posterity is with books. And so, I don't know, I'm reading all the time, but all sorts of things. Henry James, William Faulkner, I'm just reading at the moment.
I read both of the other books too, and I quite enjoyed them. I thought they were really interesting, and I sort of identified with Tessa's book because my mother was a single mother. Oh. And so there were things in there that I kept saying, where was she looking at me? I read whatever is on the shelf. I have stacks and stacks, and I just go there and I pick something up. Lately, I have been reading. Nobody's heard of this. If you've heard of this, you have to raise your hand. Miklos Bonfi's Transylvanian trilogy.
Yeah.
Yay! There is one. Congratulations. Did you like it? Oh. Neither have I. I've only gotten through volume two, but it's a wonderful sort of lost masterpiece. So that's what I've been reading lately. For contemporary things, I read what I am asked to review, and I usually enjoy it quite a bit. I do think we live in a golden age. I think there are books out there, both reprinted and new, that are fabulous and interesting, and it's too bad we don't have more time to read them.
Every year I go back to teach at Columbia, and I can set my own course. I don't have to consult anybody. The poor students have to read whatever I say they have to read. And so I teach a course called Irish Prose, and I teach a course on the novel, any novel, you know, up to a certain year. And while Irish prose, you know, people know or think they know the names, Joyce and Beckett, Oscar Wilde, you know, Jonathan Swift, you know, but there are the novels in between, figures such as Maria Edgeworth and Castle Rackrent. Mm-hmm. Poor American students. I don't know if there's anyone. Has there anyone here have ever made read Castle? They just end up thinking Thady is the most interesting person alive by the time we've gone through that class. An Irish novelist, Kate O'Brien, a novel called The Anteroom. Two Irish novelists, Somerville and Ross, who wrote together, mm-hmm. a novel called The Real Charlotte. So that every year, when I wake up on a Tuesday morning, I say, oh my God, today is Somerville Charlotte Day. And I arrive in. And sometimes I win and sometimes I lose. Sometimes everyone just goes blank on me. Because there's always a nerd, there's always a student who's waiting for Beckett, who just wants Malloy. And, he's just like, when he gets Malloy. But with the other, last year, we went back with the graduate students, and I did a course just called Henry James. And I realized that nobody's going to come. This guy's out of fashion now. How am I going to do this? So I thought, look, 200 pages a week. And that solved everyone's problem because they were busy with other work they were doing, but also it gave me time to concentrate on the 200 pages. Really look at how the novels were constructed, what you're talking about there, where you're in a class and you don't know what Isabel Archer is going to do. And I'm looking at them and saying, oh my God, you know what? You're going to have such a great week ahead of you. And then when we came to the Golden Bowl, I realized that it was almost as though I hadn't read the book. Reading it this time around, I noticed and relished things in it that were so marvelous. So I'm going back in January, and we're starting this time with Jane Austen, and we're going up to Edith Wharton, and we're going to have a really, really good time.
Can I make a suggestion? One of my absolute favorite novels is a novel by Anthony Trollope called The Kellys and the O'Kellys.
Oh, yeah. That's a great Irish novel,
yes.
By an English writer.
Yeah, yes, and it's also, of course, one of my favorites because it's about horse racing, but it is such an interesting novel because Trollope traveled all over Ireland establishing the English post office, and so he really had his eyes open. It sold like 8 copies. But it was a great beginning for him.
Yeah, he was considered an idiot by his family. And then his family told all his friends, so everyone just thought Anthony Trollope was an idiot. But then he came to Ireland, and no one knew that about him. And obviously Ireland's a very useful place in that regard. And everybody just thought, because he was English, he had to be smart in some way or other, and he had this job in the post office. So he flourished on arrival.
Yeah, and he also learned to go fox hunting, which became a lifelong obsession with him.
You should never have asked 3 writers what their favorite books are. We're not going to stop.
Another question. Yeah, right here on the aisle.
It's wonderful to hear all 3 of you. I really enjoy your work so much. I was wondering, do the changes in technology, the fact that many people spend much time reading books on Kindles, et cetera, does that have any impact on your creative process and how you're thinking about time, et cetera, and all of the various structures that you need to think about?
Why do you guys look at me first all the time? The only technological change that ever had an impact on me was that in the 1980s, when I was writing The Greenlanders, I wrote it on what was then considered to be a portable computer called a K-Pro. It was about the size of a sewing machine, portable sewing machine. And because the pages never came to an end, there are no chapters. And so I can honestly say that's the only thing technology ever did to me. I read on a Kindle, I read in a book, I read on my computer. If it's a text, I'll read it.
I still write with this thing here on paper. And the great thing that's happened in technology is, I suppose, email, because it means the telephone, then really you don't need a telephone at all for any purpose, really. And it'd be lovely soon if you don't need email either. When something wonderful new comes, because I have discovered this thing where you think, well, actually, maybe there's an important email and I should check it. And that is really, if you're trying to write a novel, I mean, eat chocolate. I mean, you know, go to the fridge. I mean, find something else. But the fact that there's no important email has ever come for anyone ever. I mean, in life. It's just no.
Do you know, Colt, there is something you can do? There's something called self-control. I really mean it. I'm not being ironic. There's an actual app called self-control.
Oh, funny.
Which I have to say I use because I was starting to do that. And you just turn it on and for 4 hours you cannot check your email.
Huh. Oh, and does it work for other things you need to control as well?
Yes, of course.
I'm not going to mention them in mixed company.
Well,
but
it would be a tag that you would hang on the bottle. Something like that, yeah.
I think the technology, that thing Jane was talking about, actually, that I do write on the computer, and I now can't imagine writing by hand. It's probably sad. But, well, it's not. Your brain just changes, doesn't it? So I can't imagine not being able to do that moving of bits of text around and going on writing sentences without a very scarred page. So that's interesting.
A couple of years ago, I was in Paris, and I went over to Passy and went to the Balzac Museum. And has anybody been there? Yes, one person has. There's a couple of rooms, and one of them, excuse me, is his office, and one of them is a room with cabinets full of page proofs that he was correcting errors. And then there's a room full of original engravings and then the engraved illustrations that were made from the engravings. And the room of page proofs, the pages are about like that, and the print is really tiny, and he's having to go like this. Mm. And I nearly knelt and said thank you that I don't have to do that. That would drive me bananas. And so, yes, it was way harder 150 years ago, and thank God it's not that hard anymore.
They have that amazing coffee pot in his house, don't they? Maybe that was why he needed those 20 cups of coffee a day.
I'm sure he did, you know. The publisher would say, I need this in 2 days, and he would stay up basically for 2 days and get it done.
But he didn't have any emails coming in.
No, he did not have any emails coming in.
It's lovely to have an American and an Irishman and a British woman, English woman, I suppose.
Sounds like a joke.
Here. Right. Well, you're in a library, not in a bar. at least not yet. I hope you'll enjoy the hospitality of Philadelphia. But I'm wondering if you see what kinds of differences you see, if any, amongst your readers in all three places. We're all reading in English, and yet there are cultural differences, and I just wonder if you have any comment on that.
That's so difficult.
I think that's for you to say. We don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
Colm knows.
Well, I mean, I know. No, I know. I know one thing only, that in this novel I have a vet. And I just thought he was a vet. And it means that he's a veterinary surgeon, meaning that he's a doctor for animals. But of course, everyone thought that this man, Phyllis, her husband, had been in some war because a vet here, you know, so that there are words that really do, that they certainly do change across the Atlantic. And I think it's important, you know, what's happened, for example, between Portugal and Brazil, considering it's meant to be the same language called Portuguese, but if you look now at a translation of say, an English book or a German book, there are different translations done between the two countries. And examine any page, and you see that some of the nouns are different, besides just basic, say, slang words, that they're doing two translations. And this hasn't happened with us because of the way in which, say, American movies continue to really exert their influence. And so we know how Americans speak. But so that the language remains as a literary language, actually a single language, which is unusual considering the great differences in the landscape or indeed in the history. But I think that's something we've got to be very careful with. For example, that we don't allow in our novels, or certainly in mine, differences in addition. Someone saying, well, maybe you should put veterinary surgeon here, you know, so Americans will know what it's about. But oh, it's okay for Ireland vet. You know, like, the, I mean, we just don't start doing that.
One year, and I can't remember what novel it was, the British publisher sent me an edited version that had been edited by a British editor, and a lot of the words had been changed. And I sent it back, and I said, no, we're not going to do that. And no, I think it's important to maintain the distinction.
But when we're reading American novels in England, we want them to be full of Americanism.
And American spellings, and we want the English ones to be, have English spellings. Yeah. And so I think that's important.
I mean, I wrote a novel, I tried to set it in America, it's called Brooklyn, and luckily she's just arrived in Brooklyn, so it's not an issue. But she, no, you're not going to applaud when I tell you this. I mean, she goes to a baseball game, so I thought, well, I should go to a baseball game. And I mean, I love your country, but I couldn't work out what was going on at your baseball game. So anyway, I wrote my novel and I gave it in, and they called up and said, you know, there's a problem with the baseball. I said, yeah, but she doesn't really know about baseball, so it's okay. No, said, no, there's a problem. I said, well, what? Well, you know that you have that at halftime, they went and had a hot dog. I said, well, yeah, I mean, we went and had a hot dog at halftime. She said, there's no halftime. I said, well, what do you call it? And they, this incredible thing called seven innings stretch. And of course, that is so far away from my ear. I've never heard it before. When I put it in the book, it's really, it just reads wrong to me. It was halftime. I'm sorry, but it's a mistake. And I, you know, but I had to do, you know, because they laughed, and they laughed so much at me that they, that when I go into the building, the Scribner building in New York, I think the porters downstairs, the guys at the door know, because they often laugh as I pass. He's the guy.
One last question, and then we have to wrap it up.
Thank you. Jane Smiley. I read 10 Days in the Hill.
I cannot believe
that.
What?
What possessed you?
It was Giovanni Boccaccio. He possessed me. 10 Days in the Hill. I read the Decameron right after 9/11, and I adored it. And so then shortly after that, I read the Heptameron, which is Marguerite of Navarre's rewriting of the Decameron, or updating it to 1540s. And so then I decided that I really did have to rewrite the Decameron and set it in Hollywood. And so I did, and it was tons of fun. And about a third of it is graphic sex. But, you know, it was Boccaccio sex. It was fun sex. It was joke sex. It wasn't pornographic sex. It's still one of my favorites, actually. So thank you for reading it.
Calm and
see, someone's
Tessa.
Leaving. So as soon as I, as soon as 10 Days in the Hills comes up, someone leaves.
We're a little puritanical here in Philadelphia. Calm, Tessa, is there a book that influenced you to write a book?
No, I don't think so. Not like that. The book I'm just finishing, I have very directly and openly borrowed the structure from another book. There's Elizabeth Bowen's A House in Paris is three sections, and it's the present, the past, the present, and I've done exactly the same in the one I'm just finishing.
So. Oh, yeah, Elizabeth Bowen. I'm going to copy her soon, too.
She's really good to copy.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Jane Smiley, Tom Thordine, Tessa Hadley.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.